Our daughters are new aunts. They have a three-year-old niece and a gigantic five-month-old nephew who's like 23 pounds. His sister's 30 pounds at three. I think in part because she's no longer the center of attention. I remember well our oldest daughter referred to her sister as it for a long time. She is in princess phase. She only wears dresses and basically wants to be treated royally, as she knows she fully deserves. Esther's story has a bit of a Disney princess story about it, a bit of Cinderella about it. But her dangers lie not in an abusive home, but within the palace herself. This is a story about a people who are living under the thumb of power. They're a colonial people. Even her name has been taken from her. Her name's Hadassah, which is still a name for a bride in contemporary Judaism. But Esther sounds like Ishtar, a goddess of Persia, a fundamental mother goddess of the Near East. One of the things I delight in speaking to adults congregations is, remember there was that awful movie with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman, Ishtar? Oh no, you don't remember it. Good, you didn't waste your money. But her name has now been taken, and it's a name of a goddess. Slightly differently than what you heard in the introduction to the book just a few minutes ago. The only reason she gets to be part of the king's harem is that the main wife, Vashti, revolts against her drunken husband wanting to show her off in front of his drunken party guest after, get this, a six-month bacchanal. Now, I know you look at that and say, oh, if I could only live that way, but this was bad in those days. And so the bureaucracy of Persia in the story goes berserk and tries to protect male hierarchy. And of course, that has to be protected by law. For our parts of the story, they have a worldwide beauty contest, a year of spa treatments and makeup, and Esther wins. And so she gets to live in the palace. Small problem. Part of the rule is the king must bid her to approach. She can't speak to her husband in the harem or Esther's people are in trouble, even though she's doing well. And now we come to a critical point, and it's this. As you heard in the introduction, her people, because of a bribe and the foolish pride of her uncle, are now under a pogrom, a death sentence throughout the largest empire the world had known, Persia. Her uncle has told her of this and basically says, do something about it. What's she going to do? She can't approach the king. She asks her uncle, have the people fast and pray. And they do, but still, she's on her own. She's between a rock and a hard place. And even though she's asked Mordecai to have the people fast and pray. The name of God never appears in this book. This is the only part of our Old Testament that's not replicated in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I guess it's one of two reasons. One, it was too new. Two, it was because God's name doesn't appear in the book. She could continue to hide her Jewish identity and continue to live in the lap of luxury. To protect her people, she's going to have to risk her position and her very life to figure out a way around the regulation. This is part of a story, then, where the underdog has to use their wits to try to win out over the upper dog. So she has to make a decision out of fear, out of loss of protection, of security, of wealth, and ease. Oh, it'll be all right, she tells to herself. As they say in 12-step programs, denial is not just a river in Egypt. It'll be okay. The moral emblem of many of us is the ostrich. If I hide and don't think about it, it'll go away. But Esther is the emblem of those who find the courage to plan and to act. She is the emblem of all of us who try to do good and find that obstacles spring up, but they are rarely insuperable obstacles. She's come face to face with what Mordecai calls a decision that help may come from another quarter, but at such a time as this, she must act. Esther comes to an enormous realization. Even if she has a vocation, a calling from God, an important decision, God continues to call us to cooperate in making what we perceive as the will of God a reality here and now. In our time, in such a time as this, the name of God rarely gets bandied about. Or if it does, it's in a curse, in a vulgar curse. My Uncle Jim was a world-class cusser. He worked in coal mines, so that was part of it. When I was 2 years old, my parents got me, I'm so old, it was made of wood, a little set. And one of the things was you got to pound a peg into a round hole. I would do it, but every time I did it, my mother heard me go, dog damn it, dog damn it, dog damn it. I had it partially right. Now, Esther doesn't rely on thoughts and prayers alone. She has to make a plan. So she hatches a plot to get the king to come to her, but also figure out a way to hoist Haman by his own petard, to make him the victim of his own pernicious plot. The king is a typical male in power, stupid, easily manipulated, egocentric, always looking for his poor, frail self to be massaged and complimented day after day. I can see the glint of recognition in a lot of eyes. That may even sound like a candidate for president. No. She plans a dinner party. And like those of us watching at a horror movie, no, don't go there. Don't open the door. Because that's what got Vashti in trouble in the first place. Is she going to be a tragic heroine? Well, no. She knows the king loves to party. She has a banquet with plenty of wine. Let's have another party. The king agrees. And Haman, his right-hand man, gets invited. He loves to brag about the wealth and position he has in the Persian Empire. He's already whined to his wife about how he doesn't get the respect he deserves. He was made sick that Uncle Mordecai got honors that he deserved because he saved the king from an assassination plot. He's so happy. Think Iago in Shakespeare's play, Othello. Think Jafar in the Disney movie, Aladdin. You get the drift. She sets things up, but she has no clue if it's gonna work or not. But things fall into place. Even more than she probably could have imagined. The part we skipped in chapter 7 goes like this. When the king is angered, he storms out to suck his thumb and pout. Haman's desperate. He throws himself on the couch of Esther, pleading for mercy. The king comes in and, being an idiot, goes, "Oh, he's trying to seduce the queen." And that's her opening to have him killed. One of the reasons she was selected as a member of the harem was she was gracious and kind to court officials, eunuchs. You all know what that is, so I won't go into that. But they could serve in the choir with the sopranos if need be. Notice it was a eunuch who suggests the way for Haman to be done away with. It fell into place. Jesus said that the disciples need to be clever in dealing with a fallen world. We seek to do good, but not naively, but in full knowledge that doing good can be difficult, strewn with obstacles and dangers, fraught with uncertainties. One of the many annoying things I find in the rise of unaffiliated churches is their buoyant, blind optimism and arrogance that seems to go, "I'm on God's side. Everything should work out great for me every day. I'm blessed." I'm sure you've run into these annoying people. "How are you?" "Blessed." I'd rather hear a parade of troubles than that, but no, the God who creates a world of freedom does not treat us as puppets on strings, but living, moral beings. We are engaged in a cooperative endeavor with God, working with, being empowered by a God who is alert, active, and alive to our lives and, yes, the difficulties we find ourselves in. We are being asked, all of us, to make decisions to help make a better world, even if it's just a little bit better. I have a good friend who calls me a good bit. I've never had him call me when life's going well. But it's usually about the latest crisis. And lately, he's been talking a lot about his prayer life for God to intervene decisively in his life and our life together as a nation and a world. If God acts that way, it's very rare. What it is God is engaged in weaving a new creation with us, responding to us, reacting to us. The story of Esther in our lives is one where God does not seem to follow a rigid script. What older Presbyterians used to call predestination in a confused way, but that we live more improvising and adapting to the circumstances on the ground. Like Esther, we learn to use what resources we have to make this world just a little easier. As we practice decisions, small deeds and large ones, we are engaged in a practice to seek everything available to us when we're called to important decisions that require discernment, faith, and courage. Our decisions flow into God's constant work to heal this world and to make it fit for human habitation and, yes, fit for the divine presence. In such a time as this, we can hide. We can wait for God's direct intervention, or we can move to our calling, our sacred vocation, our work together with God to make this life worth living for ourselves, each other, and yes, our posterity. Amen.